둘, 셋, 파!
For Hey Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 8.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Hot as f*** here.
Consequence Podcast Network.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always on the verge of death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan. Additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org. Consequence, the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks as always for making your way here. Checking out the series. You know what to do. If you like what you see, what you hear, hit that subscribe button. I put out three new interviews every single week, so it's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover some new ones at iTunes, Apple Podcast, Spotify, Podchaser, NPR, WFPK.org, or YouTube for the video versions. Really, anywhere you get your podcasts from, just subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. That's me, I'm Kyle Meredith, today talking with my old buddy Greg Dooley. There's a brand new album from the Afghan Whigs called How Do You Burn that we're going to get into. We're going to discuss how the record found a brighter tone than their last couple of LPs, having Blind Melon's Christopher Thorne on guitar, and the Saints and Sinners that populate the collection. Greg's also going to talk about, once again, duetting with Marcy May's first time in a very long time. If you're a hardcore Afghan Whigs fan, you know why that's special. We're going to, of course, talk about his long-term friendship with the late Mark Lanegan, and I'll ask about the plans for the songs that didn't make the album as well. So let's get into it. We're talking How Do You Burn? It's Kyle Meredith with Greg Dooley of the Afghan Whigs.
Kyle, how's it going?
How Do You Burn? The Afghan Whigs, back with new music once again. It's been a few years since the last record. Man, let me tell you first, I honestly mean this. This is one of the most aurally satisfying records I think I've ever heard, and might actually be the contender for what will become my favorite Afghan Whigs record. It's some records, especially as you get older, you know, it takes a little while to absorb records, and man, I'm really meaning to give you the compliment here. This record instantly hit me in all the ways that you hope for. It's great. Congratulations.
I'm glad. Thank you very much, Kyle. I appreciate that.
So let's get the backstory. As I guess it happened, you do your solo record, and of course, pandemic shuts everything down, and so you guys get to work on this one. How long have you been sitting on the record now? Was it finished this year? Have you been sitting on it for a little while?
I've been sitting on it since January. So if the supply chain was not blocked, the record would have been out probably May. But because they were waiting for the vinyl and we had to wait in line, they pushed the release till September. But that's okay. I'm fine with that.
Gives you that. Seems to be the popular thing, the really long lead out right now anyway. Because otherwise, it's sort of the thing, like, as soon as the record's out, it's sort of becomes the end of the start of the end of the campaign. Does it feel like this really has made it feel longer for you?
Absolutely. I mean, it's we've done some shows. We're going to do some more, and then we do the big fall tour. So it's actually kind of, by the time we put the record out, three songs will have been released. We're playing them all in the show already, and then you get seven more in September. So that's cool.
Yeah, and let me say testament to that live show, seeing you guys here in Louisville, which was the first time in 25 more years or what? Like, the show was so damn good.
I remember, like, talking to Scotty after the show, and I'm like, man, I don't know why we haven't been back here. It's just, it's the whim of the booking agent, Kyle. That's what I'm blaming it on. Anyway.
I'm glad it finally happened. I'm glad I was able to see you guys right here in town, too. But especially to see these songs, the ones you are playing live, and getting into the record. I mean, the one thing I first noticed about the record is the brightness is back. And I only say that in comparison to the last couple records. They felt like they had this really, and by the way, huge fan of those too, but this, sometimes mysterious, darker, and sometimes gothic set to it. What gave this one its mood shift? What do you attribute to that to anything? Like, in my mind, this closely resembles maybe like 1965 more than anything.
Probably because what was going to be darker than what was happening? You know what I mean? Like, I think even trying to compete with that was folly, So that's my best answer to that question.
But it's almost surprising because we go from one version of darkness into another one. I mean, you guys were recording this again when there was just a whole lot of confusion, uneasiness in the world. I don't know what you were feeling. Like, can you think back, I know it's just about a year and a half ago, but it's such a weird thing for all of us to think back then. Like, where was your mind? What was your mood during the recording of this, during the writing of this?
I mean, I had already been like, had that, the solo tour was already taken from me. I already was not able to go, work on to perform a record that I'd worked on for a year and a half. So I think I just kind of quickly rebounded and just started cranking out the tunes. Luckily, I had Patrick and Christopher within driving distance of me, and we were able to build the foundations of the songs and ship them back east to the other players. So that was that. But I mean, I don't know if I discussed this with you or not. I have to several people, but like, I didn't, while the uncertainty and certainly the toll it was taking on the world population, troubling, but like my personal daily experience was, I sort of spend a lot of time alone anyway. It wasn't really a big change for me. Mm-hmm. So I think that I was able to, I never sit down and go, wow, I'm going to write a dark gothic spooky song, but I think I just was, my flow was pure, like I just kind of was coming from wherever I was is what you hear. And obviously there are moments of darkness in life, but this, I do feel like this is a brighter record as well.
Especially you get to like a line of shots. Like, that's a bright song right there.
Yeah, thank you. That's the next single.
Well, then, do you find with them coming so close together, do you find that there is a thread between this record and the solo album? Like, can you sense? I don't know if I'm asking like lyrically or thematically. Like, are there any threads that you see between the two?
Well, the threads I see between the two is that, like, you know, I've the last two records I've probably pushed the vocals further to the front than I ever have. I was always kind of a fan of the Led Zeppelin, Rolling Stones, bury the vocals kind of thing, fight with the track. But I became more comfortable pushing my vocals forward. I feel like the singing has been, you know, really good on the last two. So that in particular has happened. But really just like the thing I can probably say, it's the continuation of the working relationship I have with Christopher Thorne, mm-hmm. who we have kind of a secret language now, and it goes really fast. It's fun. We're having a great time making the records, you know, so maybe that's also why it's coming out the way it is.
Yeah. And for anybody that doesn't know, Chris Thorne, probably most famously of Blind Melon, when I saw his name as being associated with the Afghan Whigs, like, I fucking love his playing and had no clue what it was going to sound like with you. You know, as we say many times, you know, you everybody is their own ingredient. And when you get together, it's always a different stew depending on who's in it. Like, how far does your all's relationship go back, and how did he become to be part of the Afghan Whigs?
I met Christopher in 96. Sean Smith introduced us in Seattle. We all were living in Seattle at the time. And I knew who he was. I had actually met Shannon 3 years previous, in 4 years previous, in Los Angeles. So I knew Shannon first, and then I met Christopher and Brad. And then Christopher and Brad moved to L.A., opened a studio in North Hollywood, which I ended up using for the Twilight Singers' "She Loves You" record. And kind of, you know, Christopher wasn't really around then either. He stopped in and say hi a couple times. But probably when he moved, he moved about a half a mile away from me in Silver Lake. And that's when I started going over all the time. So my first recordings with Christopher are probably on Due to the Beast, which we recorded in 13. Mm-hmm. And it came out in 14. So we've been working together for about 9 years now.
Yeah, it's gelled really well.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, he's one of my favorite people. I mean, I've been lucky. I've recorded with some great people, but I really have a great rapport with him, and it's incredibly rewarding to work with him.
And we'll be right back right after this.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always-on-the-verge-of-death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan. Additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.
It's Kyle Meredith with, today, talking with Greg Dooley of the Afghan Whigs. So on this record, again, How Do You Burn? I think I'm getting the quote right. Somewhere you said, you know, you like your records to have saints and sinners.
Right.
Who are these people? Who are the people of How Do You Burn? Who are the saints and who are the sinners?
Well, it's a little more complicated here because my writing has become increasingly abstract, but I will tell you where I got the idea for the song Jaija, where I was reading about this Japanese man who was building a mechanical real doll. And I was just fascinated by that story. And he was describing her soul and that they were going to be soulmates. And so he spelled it differently. But I asked a friend of mine, I was like, how is this pronounced? And so I present the song title in its pronounceable English way. But I mean, I don't know if he's a saint or a sinner, probably both. And so maybe that is, therein lies the thing. I kind of feel like the people that I sing with on this record, like there's a bunch of people, obviously Mark and Ed, but in the more pronounced ways, Van Hunt on Jaija, mm-hmm. Van Hunt on Take Me There, big part of it. My reunion with Marcy Mays on Domino and Jimmy, first Wigs duet, I believe, ever. So those were kind of my. I know I'm drifting away from your saints and sinners question, but I don't have an easy answer for it. So I'm filling in the blanks for you.
You're getting to where I would have gone anyway. So please continue. I mean, you know, it is okay. the guests are important on here, and we haven't mentioned all of them. I mean, Domino and Jimmy. You know, at first I wasn't sure. I was like, Who is singing this? You know, it's such an interesting song. And it was, is Marcy you brought out in Louisville, right? At Headliners?
Yeah. So Marcy was in a band called Skrull. We met, when we were all starting out back in the old days. And, Skrull was from Columbus. We did a bunch of shows together. We toured together. And then, when we were making Gentlemen, I had this song called My Curse. I was having trouble wrapping my head around singing it myself. I kind of felt like it should be sung by a woman. And I thought of Marcy immediately, played her the song. She loved it. She went in and crushed it. And it almost kind of has like a mythic status amongst like people who like our group, you know. So whenever Marcy shows up at a show, it's like a unicorn sighting. You know what I mean? So during when the pandemic was sort of like, you know, at its height, I'm sure you did this. I think a lot of people did this. You just start like reconnecting with people and seeing how people are doing. And Marcy and I were talking like on a weekly basis. And when I say talk, we were like talking for, you know, 2 and 3 hours at a time. So at the end of one of our conversations, I said we should do a song again someday, and she said, "Absolutely, I would love that." And when I hung up the phone, I was like, "Dude, you got to do it now. Don't be the guy who says let's do lunch and don't
do
lunch."
Right.
You know. So I wrote the song probably, I don't know, 3 days later, and then sent her the words, and she was like, what's your part? And I go, I have to listen to you sing to me first before I know what to say back to you.
Wow.
And, then I waited and I just listened to her sing, even though I wrote all of the verses, I needed to hear her sing it to me. For me to be able to reply, and that was the reply. But like from tip to tail, 1 week from my suggesting we do it to the conclusion of the mix was 1 week.
Wow, that's what an interesting way to write a song too. Just, you know, projecting yourself into someone else and then having to hear that. Like I don't know anybody else that's ever said it like that, I guess. What a cool one.
I didn't, you know, until I just said it to you, I didn't even know I did it.
I'm glad we're both getting something out of this.
Yeah, there you go.
Speaking of vocal takes, Please Baby Please might be one of my favorite vocal takes that you've ever done. And what a rich history, by the way, of those words. That line, please, baby, please. Like a kingdom of music has been built upon that.
Oh, yeah. And trust me when I say I tried everything I could to come up with a different title for it. And so that I wouldn't be sitting here with you now doing this conversation. But in the end, like, you know, John Curley was the guy who's like, come on, what are you going to call it, man? You know, like Highlander. You
know? Man, if it works, works. And it works. And I mean that too, because there are so many songs that do that. That is just white noise and wallpaper. And to be able to pull off something 2022, 60, 70, maybe 80, 90 years after these songs have been written like this, and to still make it something unique and special, like, no small feats. Well played.
Yeah, thank you. kind of my personal favorite on the record. So I appreciate the positive feedback. Thank you.
You mentioned Mark. We got to bring up Mark at least a little bit here. Boy, I sure do miss hearing him. Well, of course, I can hear him anytime, I guess. But So as I read, it was him who you ended up taking the title from. How Do You Burn?
Yeah, he was. We talked a lot. He was, you know, one of my closest friends, one of the closest friends I'll ever have. Mm-hmm. And I years ago I named one of his records just like offhandedly. I said something, he loved it. He's like, can I use that? And I was like, of course. I didn't know what I said. And the same thing happened with him. We were talking and he said those words and I was like, what? And he goes, what? And I go, what did you say? And he goes, I don't know. And I go, did you say, how do you burn? And he goes, I guess so. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? He goes, you know, how do you burn? Like what makes you burn? What turns you on? You know? Uh-huh. And I was like, all right, I'm taking that. And he was like, go right ahead. So there you go.
And as I took it, the answer is the final track, In Flames. Like, how do you burn? In Flames.
Sure. Exactly. Yeah. In Flames, the shattering conclusion. In Flames is Patrick's favorite song on the record. So we'll be working that one up at some point into the show. It kind of gave it, like, you know, it was the last song that I wrote, and it gave it its kind of, you know, I don't want to use the word closure, but it gave it its fitting denouement. That's what I'm going to go with.
You and Mark, are there stuff, is there more out there that you all did together? Are there unreleased Gutter Twins?
No. We used, trust me, we used everything. Like, you know, but the last thing that we did outside of these songs when we did Girl from the North Country, that was a B-side on one of my, it was like a Record Store Day record. Mm-hmm. And he sang the Johnny Cash part and I sang the Dylan part.
That's a fun one, I guess, if you got to go out on one. That's not a bad one right there. Yeah.
Yeah. If you don't have it, I'll send it to you.
Please do. It's hard to find that RSD stuff after the facts, unless you want to shell out.
I don't think it's on. I don't know if it's on streaming service. So I'll take a look, but I'll send you what I have.
Yeah, please do. What about the, you know, it's sort of the same question. What about the songs though that weren't used on this? I mean, what about, I was trying to do the math, 14 songs that aren't on the record?
There's about that, like I mean, and by the way, like, they're not 14 like finished songs.
Sure, right.
I don't. What happens is once I get, you know, smell blood, I go all in on one, and I'll leave a song just kind of like, you know, on the side of the highway. And maybe I'll go back later and strip it for parts. Maybe I'll go back and tow it in and put it back on the road. It depends. But I'll say this: there's four that we didn't use that are great and will come out. They just didn't fit this record, and I've become a big fan of the 10 song record. So it had to be these 10. Yeah. They were. That's how it was going to go.
I've become such a big re-champion. Something I've always loved is the B-side. I miss the B-side. I miss singles because of the B-side. Because usually, as you're saying, they were sort of the songs that weren't seen all the way through a lot of the times. You know, they weren't completely finished, but they were recorded. And there's something special about that to me, too. You know, I miss that stuff.
I mean, you think about like back in the 70s and 60s where like they would, I mean, think about like for instance, like Blackwater by the Doobie Brothers. Mm-hmm. That was the B-side.
Right.
And it became their, I want to say their only number, or maybe their first number one, probably What a Fool Believes was probably a second one. But anyway, that one. Countless Beatles songs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of those Beatles albums were like, you know, Beatles songs were like double A side. But to me, the champion of the B side was Prince.
Oh, yeah.
His B sides were, you know, anybody else's A side, you know. So he was the king of the B side, I think.
Well, if you ever want to, you can compete in that arena right there, and I'll shell out for that stuff. That's true. I will hunt them down. You.
All right. Cool.
Whatever you got left over, just throw them on the B sides.
Right on. Well, I'll be sending you this Dylan track. I love it, and I haven't been able to listen to it in a while. So it's very emotional, and he sings it so beautifully that I'm not exactly ready for it, but I'll find it and just text it to you so I don't have to listen to it.
Seriously, How Do You Burn? It's so damn good. I could have went through every song and talked about it in such specific ways. I love this album, man. You know, I'm such a big fan of what you do. So thanks for continuing to do what you do.
Thank you, Kyle, and great to talk to you. I hope I see you sooner than I did last time.
We'll make it happen, man. I know we will.
All right, man.
That was just back in 2018, the last time Greg and I spoke. You know, and in this new interview, I referenced how much this new album, How Do You Burn, kind of reminds me of their album called 1965 that came out in 1998. Just coincidentally, that was the last time Greg and I talked. We got to talk about that album, 1965. So I'm going to include that interview here as well. We got into the darkness that bookended the record and how a voodoo curse may have set the band in motion for destruction. So here's part two, Kyle Meredith with the Afghan Whigs.
Hi, Kyle.
So you doing all right?
Really good. A little sad to be living in a world without Aretha Franklin, but happy she's not in pain anymore.
Yeah, I thought that actually might be a nice place to start. I figured you'd have some nice things to say about Aretha, the big soul fan that you are. And
well, my mom used to listen to Aretha when I was a kid, so she was a voice that I've known since I was before I could talk, and just, you know, amazingly comforting, and you know, I used to I'd watch her on interview shows and stuff, and she just seemed like someone that I would like just a beautiful person, you know, kind of from my, just up the road, just up I-75, you know, Detroit people and Cincinnati people, yeah, we mostly get along, except you know, around baseball time.
Yeah. You know, she has that moniker for a reason as the queen.
Absolutely. And, you know, had worked with great songwriters, worked with great producers, and I mean, really, dude, that voice, like her ability to inhabit a song, you know, like taking songs from the people who wrote them, even, you know, like with respect off the top of my head.
Carole King.
Carol King, Burt Bacharach. I mean, as much as I love Dion's version of Say a Little Prayer, Aretha owns it, you know, like just full on. Like it was strange when I saw that she passed. It was the first song I thought of when I saw that she had passed away. Say a Little Prayer is just a kind of a perfect song, and a song from deep in my childhood, you know, both hers and the Dionne Warwick version.
Yeah.
But massive loss, but what a mark she left.
Yeah, I was happy that I guess we got a little warning going into it, and not for us, but for her, because a lot of times, you know, with Petty, you know, that was so sudden, and then all the tributes, you know, had to happen afterward, obviously. But knowing that her friends were calling her and that she was able to talk to them and in whatever way, I imagine that it was also getting to her that all these tributes were already in motion, you know, and the outpouring was kind of happening.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, probably not many as beloved as Aretha Franklin, you know,
right?
Like, around the world, old and young. Like, I mean, she did nothing but good things. So that's quite a legacy to leave behind.
We'll use that as a bit of a seg into the main topic here. And that's, I wanted to call you about, you know, one of the Afghan Whig records, 1965, hitting its 20th anniversary this year. And I think it's maybe in October, if I remember right.
You know what? I'll bet you that is right. We recorded the record during the winter. So, yeah, it usually takes, I think we finished it in, I want to say we were still messing with it in May. So May, June, July, August. So yeah, 5 months. Yeah, that's, we did. We worked on it because we wrote it in New Orleans. Everyone, I was already living in New Orleans, and the rest of the band rented a house, and we worked on it we built it really from the ground up in New Orleans.
It's probably good to kind of start with, you know, the stuff beforehand, because people have said this is when you finally landed on that soul sound that maybe you'd been searching for a while. I've always thought of it as one of your poppiest records. There are songs on here that's very, very accessible in a pop sort of way. But when I look at the backstory of the times leading up to this, that's almost surprising that this record sounds in anything like that, because from what I gather, it wasn't a good time in your life going into this record.
You know what? Right before it was not. But I was actually treated for depression before I went back down to New Orleans. So I was actually in a very good place at the time. But I began to acquire vices that would cause me trouble years down the line. A turning point in a lot of ways. You know, it was out of the darkness into the light, but it wasn't much longer till I was back in the darkness. But at the moment, it was really like kind of, I mean, we were kind of living like the Rolling Stones down there. Like, you know, like, I mean, that it was, we were having a great time. So probably the most fun I've ever had making a record,
yeah.
Just in terms of like rock and roll debauchery and being in a place where you could comfortably do it, you know. So it's definitely, you know, I mean, it has, there is a darkness in pretty much all my stuff, but this has the brightest lights in it too, I think. Like, some, you know, some, like a song like Something Hot or 66 or Cité Soleil, or just off the top of my head, Crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they're really pretty melancholy free, you know what I mean? Like they're joyful even at times, you know what I mean?
Was that like a reaction against all of that? Because I besides the depression, I mean, you left the record label, you lost a drummer around this time. I read that you had to do a lot of this record maybe from your own pocket, you know, to pay for it. So were these bright sounds just sort of a big reaction against whatever had happened previously?
I think probably. I mean, we were free. You know, we had, I did pay for the record, by the way, but I had no doubt that what we were about to do was going to, you know, pay me back. So that there wasn't really any kind of, oh no, I'm driving my car off the cliff. But, you know, once we got it started and started having a good time, I mean, it was, I think, you know, the initial intention was to kind of make a party record and freak everybody out. You know, the original title of the record was Stand Up to Get Down, and honestly, probably a better title. But we ended up settling on 1965, and I can't tell you how many people come up and tell me they love 1969, and I'm like I love it too, but that's by another man.
Missed it by 4 years.
You know, yeah. But thank you. So really, yeah, I mean, but again, a great time. I had been down there for like 6 months previously working on the first Twilight Singers record, which didn't come out till much after that one. So I knew the town pretty well. That's when I met Henry Butler. That's when I met Kermit Ruffins. That's when I met Roderick Paulin, who ended up doing all the horn stuff on all the records, like kind of writing the horn part. Steve Myers was around all the time. Susan Marshall came down with her husband, Jeff, who engineered the record later on, and she became a big part of the record too. So it was all very kind of family style, you know, but again, a really good time. There was darkness on both sides of the record, but during the making of the record, it was pretty bright, I have to say.
The sexual confidence is different too, because you know, that's always sort of been a part of your lyrics in some way or the other. It sounds like it's different on this one, and maybe because it's what you're talking about, the mood of down there, because I think there's more bravado in the come on lines that's happening throughout the record.
Well, it's the great thing about songwriting is you can create a new person and you can be that person for 3 or 4 minutes. So sure, I was enjoying being several of those people.
And what a place to do it in.
Sure.
Yeah. We brought up 66, and I think that one you're really centered on, because when you listen to that guitar part, and I'm not the only one who said this, like at that moment in time, you're like, that could have been a Backstreet Boys song, just with it, if it had a different vocalist melody and all that stuff on it. But like, that seems like when I listen to that song, and I love that song, by the way, I love that song. But there's something about it going, man, if you were ever shooting for the top of the pop charts, you know, that was the one.
There you go. And it was really strange, like that the record label didn't kind of get that. You know what I mean? I kind of swung for the fences on those songs, probably for the last time. I think I kind of retreated back into my darkened room after that. Yeah, I mean, I thought there were a couple hits on that record. I honestly did. And I thought 66 was one of them. 66, Crazy, Uptown Again, Something Hot, John the Baptist were all like big up-tempo, all of side one, really. You know what I mean?
Right.
Soleil, like, I mean, it's very infectious and super fun to play. So on any given day, it could be my favorite record that I've ever done. Yeah.
And John the Baptist, by the way, that might as well be your Sympathy for the Devil or Gimme Shelter, because it's otherworldly the way it sounds. You know, it doesn't sound like humans created that song, or at least the way I hear it.
Wow. Well, thank you. I love John the Baptist, and the having that horn section and having Susan sing on it with me. I mean, when you have that much power behind you, there's nothing you can't do. And I think that, we mixed a record with George Draculius and David Bianco, who just passed away a few months ago. And they really, really understood the dynamics of that song and did an excellent job mixing it.
I never knew this until just, like, the research of this record, but Alex Chilton, is he somewhere on this record?
Alex Chilton sings the vocal harmony on Crazy.
I did not know that.
Oh yeah, like big time. Like play it and you'll hear him. It's plain as day. It's you know, it's Alex Chilton. He's the only guy who can sound like that. You know, he made me sound good, like I said. And he was I hung out with Alex quite a bit when I lived down there.
Yeah, and this was sort of before the whole, when the world finally started catching on in real, I think, because in the 90s, it was still sort of a, what I call a handshake band, you know, the secret handshake, like, oh, you know, Chilton, you know, Big Star.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I remember, like, I had, The Letter was one of my favorite 45s when I was a boy. And when I started hearing about Big Star, and that he was that dude, and that he was like 16 when he sang The Letter. It's very Steve Winwood, you know, like right. Very child prodigy, like a dude who sounded like a kid who sounded like a man, so a kid who sounded like a black man.
a white kid who's like a black man, you know what I mean? So, but yeah, man, Alex sings on Crazy, and Jody Stevens, Big Star's drummer, sings on Now You Know on Gentlemen. So I sang with half of Big Star.
Yeah, you just called him up and asked him. Is that you sort of had that in mind or what?
I had it in mind, and Jeff Powell, the engineer, knew Alex from Memphis. Jeff Powell lives in Memphis, and he knew Alex and called him. And Alex came over to the studio and listened to it. And I'm going to be shocked if it wasn't one take or two takes. He did it. He did it immediately. He knew exactly what to do. And it was phenomenal.
Yeah, what a moment. What a moment that must have been. Not a question here, but I'll also throw in, it makes me giggle every time I hear you kind of whisper that who's hot, who's not part.
All right. Well, thank you.
That's a great little
moment. I loved that song, man. I loved the Mace, Puff Daddy, Biggie, Diana Ross jam. So Mo Money, Mo Problems, I believe is the name of the song. Loved that, and always, you know, always love ad libs. I used a bunch of Outkast ad libs on Powder Burns, the Twilight Singers record. Whenever I go listen to $40, it's like, you know, I'm practically dry humping. Hey, yeah.
Do you do those moments live too? Do you drop that Puffy in still?
I have. I don't play Crazy a lot, but and sometimes I would and sometimes I wouldn't. But you know, anticipating the reaction, I'll do it. I know how people dig stuff, and I'm like, and I dig it too. So I would absolutely do it again. Yes.
So you're talking about the Darkness on the Other Side of the record. I mean, this was the final one for a while. It was after this, you all sort of broke up. Did you see that the end was on the way at all?
I actually did not. But when there was an incident down in Austin, Texas, where I got creamed in the head after a show by these guys. And that was sort of the end. The one thing I'll give you a story about 1965 that probably no one knows. And Steve Myers, who sings on the record, my dear beloved friend, sings with a group called Mighty Fine in Brooklyn right now, but we've been pals since Black Love. He and I were walking down, I think, like Dauphine Street in the French Quarter, and this Haitian woman was walking down the street, and like, you know, we just, you know, I'm sure we probably started to say hello to her, and she shook a gris-gris bag at us and said something in French and walked away, and we were like, whoa. That didn't seem friendly, you know what I mean? It seemed really strange. And long story short, I got conked in the head, and 5 months later, Steve got shot 6 times in uptown in New Orleans. So I don't know, but I've always felt like whatever was in that gris-gris bag, we had to had a price on it, and both of us had to pay it. So
man. That's,
there you go.
That's a rough little, yeah, that's a rough moment.
I'm just saying it because I was thinking about when I knew I was going to talk to you, I'm like, I'm going to tell Kyle about the gris-gris bag. You know, they have rarely told anyone that fact, but that's a fact. And I'm pretty sure that those were the respective consequences.
Right. All right, that's amazing. That's interesting. You know what? And again, this is maybe sort of an awkward pivot, and I want to move closer to the present for just a moment too, because you know, as we're talking about the darker sides and death, Rosser, who passed away, I guess a year ago now. How has that affected whatever you're doing moving forward? Like, have you all started on whatever the next phase is, and with that in mind?
Oh, of course, we're a very show must go on gang. You know, and I don't think that Dave would think we would stop. You know, like if you've ever lost someone close to you, it's, you know, it's always profound and kind of hard to put into words. But I find that the best way to remember and keep someone's energy around you is to keep them in your heart at all times. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'll just, I have random thoughts about Dave Rosser every day, every day. I'll just think of something funny that he did or some way he smiled or whatever. But like, you know, I've had three or four already today. You know, he was absolutely one of the closest friends that anyone could ever have. And, you know, to me, he was like a soulmate to me. You know, like when I met that dude, I was like, wow, I've known you for thousands of years. You know what I mean? So in that regard, you know, not unlike sure the people, you know, up with Aretha when passed on, it's, you know, your family and the people that you've influenced, whether that be, you know, in your community or in her case, in the universe, you know, the energy you leave behind, I think stays forever.
Yeah. So. My friend Charles, just the other day, he had lost some family members, and we were sort of talking about a similar thing right there. And he said the most beautiful line. He said, he goes, you know, you don't really ever die until the very last person who remembers you has also died. Because of that, your energy, your memory is still around. It's still being used, you know, it's in some way.
Well, sure. But there's also, I mean, I don't think that ever really dies either, because think about like a story that someone told you about someone that you never knew, but you know their name, or you know that you were the friend of the friend. I think that also keeps people alive, you know, like, I just had profound recognition of people that in my life that it makes it seem like I encountered them on another plane somewhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've thought that since I was a kid. Like, you know, whatever deja vu is, whatever, you know, whatever these things are, it's they're coincidences or they're remembrances of something that you either already did or haven't done,
right.
You know? But, you know, I mean, we could take a deep dive into a metaphysical ocean right now if we don't watch out.
So. Right. That's entirely true. I'll go ahead and then ask you about if you kind of know what's next, you know, as far as the next step. I know there's been a couple one-off singles since the last record, hasn't there?
No, there was, we just did, You Want Love.
Oh, that was it.
The Pleasure Club song. We did that. That was sort of like, you know, Dave Rosser and I had talked about doing that forever, and we knew James, who wrote the song, and James actually sings on the song. So that was special, and I know it was special for James because James loved Dave, and we all, it was just a way to kind of honor our friend. And the Afghan Whigs as a collective, I'll tell you how we've made the last couple records. Like, we get together in New Orleans two or three times a year, sometimes four, and for like a week or 10 days, and we work stuff up and we put it in the bank, and then everybody else is working on other stuff. I'm working on, I don't know if you know, Mark McGuire. He was the guitarist in a group called Emeralds and has made several amazing solo records. He's downstairs in my studio right now, and we're working on some stuff of our own. So, I think everybody's kind of, I think we're going to take a little break, the Whigs. Like, I know we're getting together in December for our, you know, quad annual meetup, but I know a couple of us are going to do our own thing for a little while. But, you know, I mean, let me just say without any, you know, so to remove any ambiguity, the Afghan Whigs are an ongoing concern and shall be until we tell anyone otherwise. We've gone pretty hard the past, you know, since we got back together. You know, we've done three tours in 6 years, and three world tours in 6 years, and made two records. I think we all deserve a little not do that for a minute. You know,
I've honestly enjoyed those records too. They, you know, I want to say they sometimes sound like gothic period of the band more so than you've ever done. And maybe that's the iconography that goes along with the artwork that kind of paints the picture of the sound that I hear. But I've loved the mood of these records so much. And they're some of my favorite songs that you all have done.
Thank you. You know what? And us too, by the way, like, and I have to say that we're lucky enough to play for a group of people who come to watch us play, and they let us do what we want. We'll always throw other stuff, but we're, you know, like just being some kind of like, you know, jukebox band, just never wanted to be that, man. You know what I mean? And the only way I was ever going to, you know, sing for the Afghan Whigs again was if we had new material, always, and always cranking new material. So the next time the Afghan Whigs play, because we just played last weekend, and that'll be it for a while. I don't think anybody's keen to go on tour for a minute, a hot minute.
Yeah.
But when it happens again, I don't know in what form I will appear in, but I've always got something cooking, Kyle, I'll tell you that much.
Well, I saw a picture of you and Lanigan, which I know is, you know, that happens from time to time, and I think there are fans out there who would love another Gutter Twins record somewhere down the road.
I think there'll be a Gutter Twins record somewhere down the line, but make no mistake, Mark Lanigan is the hardest working man in show business.
That guy
has a solo record already in the can. He just, the amazing Duke Garwood. And I know he's doing a record with his wife too, which I've heard some of that, and it's fantastic. So no one has a heavier dance card than Mark Lanigan. And you saw a picture of me because, as I always do, I come over on a song or two on Mark's every time he puts them. And it's always a thrill because I love his songs and I love to sing with that guy, man. We sing really well together, and it's fun to sing with him.
Well, I always look forward to anything you put out, and I'll continue doing so. I'll actually only wrap it up by saying I realize that the most recent people I talked to and who I'm about to talk to in the next interview, you have connections, I think, with every single one of them, because today I just posted an interview with Wayne Kramer, which I believe you'd been.
I love Wayne.
Yeah.
And if I'm not in his book, bum.
And then Mark Arm? I just talked to him earlier from Mudhoney, which that's
Mark Arm.
Yeah, the Sub Pop connection there. And then tomorrow I talk with Ani DeFranco. So
please give Ani my best.
I will.
And I'll tell you what, I was actually, somebody brought that up to me that didn't know it. And they were like, hey, did you sing with Ani DeFranco? And I'm like, I've sung with Ani DeFranco a lot. But she sings on, I think, three songs on Powder Burns and one song on Dynamite Steps, or maybe two. So please give her my best. She is one of my favorite people.
I will absolutely do that. Absolutely. Okay. Greg, thank you so much. Thank you so much for the conversation here. I loved having it, and for the music, and we'll see you around at some point.
Always a pleasure, Kyle. Have a great day. Viva Aretha.
Borahe Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 8.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
So let's keep this Greg Dooley love fest continuing. This one, I think, heads back to 2014, 2015. It's when the Afghan Whigs released their album Due to the Beast in 2014. So Greg and I once again got to talk, this time about that album's gothic imagery, recording live, and a lot more. So here's part three, Kyle Meredith with the Afghan Whigs.
What's up, Kyle?
I've been so excited to hear all of this new music finally. The songs that are out there sounds amazing so far. You guys have done it again, man.
Well, thanks, man.
I guess, you know, we start with the last record. With the comeback record out of the way, did it feel more like business this time around? Was there a different sense going into this record than the last time?
Sure. basically like back to work. But this one was done a little more cohesively, and with most of this record was cut live with everyone in the room together. At least the basic tracks of 8 of the 10 songs were done that way. So in that regard, much different than the last record, which was like iterations of members of the group. You know, this was the entire six-man group, all hands on deck.
And I know everyone's sort of concentrated on the darkness of these songs and everything, but I got to say, I've had a lot of fun listening to it. Like, they may be dark songs, but they're fun dark songs.
I don't think they're like mopey. They have a degree of mischief involved with them as well. That, you know, their songs don't all have to be, you know, people are multidimensional. I think the songs are too. They can be fun and sexy and complicated and scary all at once, you know, kind of like, I'm not going to say it on the air. So.
There's the mystery in itself.
Dot, ellipsis.
Well, I think a lot of that does come from the imagery of this. You know, I was kind of laughing when Demon in Profile came out because you'd gone from a beast to a demon. And, you know, that definitely, and of course the artwork in itself. I mean, there's a lot of imagery that's just projected in there that sort of does set the tone. Whether you mean to set it in that way or not, I guess it's the way it's perceived. So when everyone starts concentrating on that, I'm guilty of it too. You know, that was the first thing I saw was this portrait of a gothic America, I guess.
Right, sure. Or is it a tribute to Dio?
I would love it if you said 100% that this record is a tribute to Dio.
I will tell you this. Big fan of Ronnie James Dio. Met him once. Could not have been a nicer person.
That's good. Yep. I mean, you want people to live up sort of to the idea, but it's nice to hear that they're all human too. All you musicians are human.
Man, I saw Ronnie James Dio singing Rainbow, so I go back that far.
You got me on that one. I'm a little bit behind you. You know, I'll ask this question because it seems to be part of every interview that I'm in right now. But is some of this imagery have anything to do with what's been going on with everything happening out there?
The artistic imagery?
Sure. Or even, just the metaphorical imagery in your lyrics. You know, dark music for dark times, that whole cliche.
Sure. Well, I've lived through other dark times, you know. Like, when things politically don't go your way, you know, I mean, it's not the only time it has happened in my life. Mm-hmm. I think this particular gentleman is, you know, a rarer case, and obviously has really cranked up people in a way they haven't been cranked up in a long time. And honestly, in that regard, if it took something like this to make people pay attention to what's going on around them, hey, you know, maybe he did everybody a favor.
Well, I guess, though, that's the question, though. Did you find that it affected your writing at all?
Well, I mean, you know what affected me was the just the never endingness of it. That campaign was always like, it was like herpes all day long. You know what I mean? Like it just kept coming back. Like, I mean, I was exhausted by it, you know, like, and the negativity, the daily negativity of it, like, it was suffocating to me, honestly. I really didn't like anybody involved in it. You know what I mean? And just wanted it to go away. And then once it began to come into focus, I was like, oh dear. But that's the way life works, you know?
Well, on the more personal side for you guys, did Dave's health affect this album?
We were pretty much done with the record when we found out that Dave was sick. And the only thing I had left to do was to write the lyrics for I Got Lost and sing them. And that's the only performance that came after the diagnosis. So, okay. You know, I mean, we were all unaware, Dave included, during the making of the record.
Well, back on the song side of things, and again, you've got two singles out as we're recording this, Demon in Profile, which is I'm going to go ahead and say a monster of a song. It's so good. But then Arabian Heights comes out, and that groove, I mean, that's got to be one of the best grooves you guys have ever laid down to tape.
Yeah, I love that groove. And I've said this many times, but, like, we're riding on the thoroughbred that is Patrick Keeler. And that is his drum. Like, it's follow the drummer, you know. He changes it up 3 or 4 times during that song, but never, ever lets it go, you know. And a rock band is as good as a drummer. And we have a great one.
Was that also live with everybody in there?
Yes, absolutely. The only songs that were not recorded live are Birdland and The Spell. The other 8 songs are all recorded live.
I mean, it really has lent something to this record because, like I said, I love the last record, and I think I gushed to you enough about that one as well. But this one feels like something entirely different. And, you know, if you want to call this version 2 of the Afghan Whigs, you know, or whatever, it's such a different trajectory than your first time around, which I'm sure is something an artist needs to hear as well as go after.
That's what you aspire to do as an artist, you know, is keep pushing yourself. Like if we were to have come back and just done, you know, anything that we've done before, it's sort of like, who cares, you know? We wouldn't. I mean, I enjoyed doing the reunion tour, but we did like 60-something shows. I mean, I was singing songs that were half my life ago. So you have to have something in front of you that, you know, appeals to the person you are now. So I think we've done an excellent job of representing ourselves as who we are now.
I do love it, man. It was a pleasure talking, as always. I hope we do get to see you in Louisville sooner than later, whether in a show or just stopping by.
I'm going to make it a point to play a gig in Louisville, Kyle.
I hope so.
So. There you go.
All right, take care, sir.
All right, and we'll round it out one more interview, all the way back to 2012 for this one. In fact, this is when the Afghan Whigs had just reunited after 13 years away from each other. So myself with my friend Sean Cannon, we got to sit with Greg backstage at Lollapalooza that year. So here's part 4, Kyle Meredith with the Afghan Whigs.
This dude here, his name is Greg Dooley, and we can once again say Greg Dooley of the Afghan Whigs.
Yes. You always could.
Could we?
Yeah, man. You know.
I thought that was illegal.
Yeah. Well, some artists don't, you know.
You could say Greg Dooley from the Black Republicans, which was my band before that, or Greg Dooley from Helen Highwater, my high school band. Spelled Helen, H-E-L-E-N.
This is Greg Dooley from Helen Highwater. Cincinnati, Ohio.
Hamilton, Ohio.
Hamilton, Ohio. Sorry.
Get it straight. There's a difference.
And we were named by Alan Collins from Lynyrd Skynyrd, personally.
Is that right?
And our guitar player later joined Lynyrd Skynyrd. Mike Estes. True story.
News. That's it right there. It is nice, though, to have you as, once again, Greg Dooley of the Afghan Whigs. I mean, what, 13 years?
13? Yep.
Read the story about how it kind of all came back together. But, you know, there were years there when you were like, I'm never going to do it again. I don't need to do it. Got the Twilight Singers, got a twin, right. Don't need to do it anymore.
Right.
But then it all came around. You did. The thing about it is you did it while everyone else was reuniting. So I think there was a bit of a misconception. Like, some people do it for the money, but I guess you
didn't. We got together with all those other bands and said, you guys do it and kind of camouflage us while we do it.
So you're undercover.
As soon as the Stone Roses tipped,
yeah, right. That was
the signal for us. See, it was a bunch of signals.
Yeah.
At the drive-in, Stone Roses, and then it was okay. Because everybody was like, meow, 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 meow.
When is that tour happening?
What's up?
At the drive-in, Stone Roses, and Afghan Whigs.
I think that's booked already, isn't it?
Well, minus the roses.
I hope we go on first.
No,
you'd be the headliners.
You hold yourself well. You guys still sound good. What does it take to get to do a reunion? Like, now you've lived it. Now you've done it. Now you're one of those bands. But you know, what does it take to finally say, I mean, is there a hatchet to bury? Or is there just a sense of...
There was no hatchet to bury. There's just like, you know, deal with the crazy one.
That's you, right?
No. And, you know, make sure that the parent isn't gone too long from the kid. And, you know.
I mean, I've got people from my past that I don't want to be around, no matter how much you pay me, but...
Right. Well, here's the thing about whenever people say that you're doing it for the money,
I always got paid for doing a gig since I was in high school.
Sure.
I did it for the money then, too. It was like $5. So that's my point. Like, money, whatever. I mean, I wasn't making money for 13 years, and I was like, oh, I need to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I did it because it's mine, and I want to. And, you know, I wrote 6 albums worth of songs that I'd like to sing again.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
That's pretty simple.
Well, I think that, here's the thing. We're talking about this music stuff. That's cool and all. What I want to know is, have you been following the Reds this year?
I'll tell you what, man. Todd Frazier got to be considered for Rookie of the Year.
Bryce Harper, no. Todd Frazier, he is the guy.
A more complete player at this particular stage. Bryce Harper, very good. Todd Frazier, my personal pick for Rookie of the Year.
You know, he was in the AAA system in Louisville, which is where we're from. So I got to see him a few times.
Scotty and I, Scotty Halter from Louisville, Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
And I, we met when Scotty was tour managing Fancy Pants, which was
with Peter Searcy.
Peter Searcy and Ben Daughtry, former Squirrel Band members, and they left town. And Scotty needed a place to crash, so he crashed at my house. But we figured out that we've known each other 25 years because we found out when Ron Oster got injured in 1987. And we've known each other 25 years as of July 13th.
Nice.
I like that you... This is the amazing thing, because music and sports doesn't always mix. But what you're telling me is that you measure the milestones in your life based on what is happening to the Reds.
Yes. The Reds are like one of my favorite things in the world. They're like, there's like Marvin Gaye, pizza, the Reds.
So it's
chicks.
Pizza though is two?
Chicks.
So you're not really a Reds fan. I thought you were, but pizza's two?
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Nah, it's okay, you're good. Pizza's good too. That's three for me. I just flipped.
I think I'm gonna appeal to you though. You brought up Fancy Pants at Squirrel Bait. You might be the only person in the world that can get a reunion out of that.
I tried.
Yeah.
Did you?
I tried real hard, yeah.
How'd that go over?
Well, they didn't say no right away, but we shot it down. I think Searcy and Grubbs shot it down, I think.
Yeah.
Nah, just do it. Make it happen again.
It's going to have to happen.
Just tell them. In fact, here's what's going
to
happen.
Everybody wants to see it again. Everybody wants to see the skag and the setup. Everybody wants to see Squirrel Bait. I saw Squirrel Bait. I saw it twice.
Before my time.
Wow, you saw Squirrel Bait twice.
Yeah.
I loved you before.
He had party with the Sun God.
Yeah, I'm aware of that, but you are my hero. You've seen him twice.
I saw him with both drummers.
Really?
I saw him with Britt and with Ben.
There you go. All right. I'm going to pull it back around here. I don't want to get back to the wigs. I'm sure you're asking this all the time. Is there going to be new wigs? Are you going to...
We played a new song today.
Did you?
At the end of the show.
Because you got some great covers that you're doing right now, which, by the way, lazy journalism has followed your career the whole time, where people go, so you like that old R&B, huh?
Yeah.
They always bring that up. But one of the more interesting things is the style of covers you're doing is R&B. It's just new R&B. You're doing Drake and Frank Ocean.
But, I mean, think about it. We did, like, we were doing Creep by TLC right when it came out. I was doing that song before it came out because I had a pre-release of that song. So...
You stumped them.
Yeah.
You know.
Who is that playing?
That's the Shins.
Right there.
Yeah. You're following James Mercer here. Or you're competing with James Mercer.
I like James Mercer.
Yeah.
I like Broken Bells too.
Yeah. He's no Tony. What are you gonna do?
No. You know what, man? That song "Let's Get Down," the Tony song.
Oh yeah.
That DJ Quick produced. It's on the final Tony record.
Man, it's got going deep into the catalog.
You know what? And it was very in that song. Like, you could have mashed "Smells Like Teen Spirit" into that song. It's the same. Cadence.
So what you're saying is we're gonna get DJ Pete Rose doing a mashup of those two songs.
The Pete Rose reality show is coming soon. Did you know that?
No.
Him and his hot Asian wife.
Guys, we gotta wrap it up.
I need to know more about this though.
This is part two. We're gonna get to
Google that. I'll be down a little bit before you know it.
Greg Dooley, Afghan Wigs.
All right, thanks,
Gunner
guys.
Twins.
Helen, it was great.
Something.
Helen Highwater.
Helen Highwater. Helen Highwater.
Black Republicans.
And my thanks again to Greg Dooley. The new album is called How Do You Burn? Big thanks to Greg, big thanks to you for checking out the episode. Please do hit that subscribe button before you get out of here. Again, you get 3 brand new interviews every single week. That's a new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to keep you up to date on your favorite artists and discover some new ones at iTunes, Apple Podcast, at Spotify, Podchaser, NPR, WFPK.org, or YouTube for the video versions, anywhere you get your podcast from. Subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Then after that, head over to WFPK.org, where I do a show Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern. That's an hour full of song premieres, of music news, anniversary spins, bonus interviews, Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on the social media spots, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all 3 of them. The address is at Kyle Meredith. I do hope you like and follow along. That does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time. Consequence Podcast Network.
We all got COVID at the very end of that tour.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.